This week we've got Gideon Mayhew from the Icon Factory, one of my favorite websites. Plus, David Cohen, me, and John Nemo. My Mac Podcast 185.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And like I said at the beginning of the show, we've got Gideon Mayhew from the Icon Factory, and David Cohen is joining me right now. Hello, David.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. This week, we do not have a Cool Mac Picks with Sam Levin. We don't have Guy Searle. We don't have Lee at the moment. He might show up later. So right now, it's just going to be you and me hosting the show, David.
Well, I guess we'll just have to keep the ship on course.
So we are joined right now by Gideon Mayhew. You are one of the principals and the designer, one of the designers from the Icon Factory, correct?
Hey, thanks for having me. That is correct.
Man, you guys have been around since 1996, right?
Yeah, we've been here in internet terms forever.
At the moment, you got this whole, and I think this is really cool, a whole Indiana Jones motif going. What's up with that?
Yeah, we've been working on that for quite some time, actually. Anthony Perino is the artist behind the Raiders indie sets at the Icon Factory. He did the original Raiders set a few years back. And this time around, Paramount came to us.
And, really?
Yeah, and asked if we would be willing to re-release them along with updates for the other movies and the new movie that's coming out tomorrow.
And so they literally came to you and said, we love the icons before, can you guys make some new ones?
Yeah, it was an awesome little exchange we had between us, and of course we jumped at the chance to do it for them.
So what did you have to do to update them?
They used to be, of course, before Leopard came out, they're just standard Mac OS X icons with maximum sizes of 128. And now with Leopard, you know, we go all the way up to 512 for cover flow. So we had to go back in and update them for the new large size and include more detail. And we actually, Anthony went in and redid a bunch of the icons. The arc is like completely different than it was before.
So it looks really cool. Now, I noticed that the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull icon isn't there. Are you waiting for the movie to actually be released?
Yeah, we. It's funny because the entire time we were working on the first three films' icons, we were begging them to get resources for the new movie, you know, for stuff to draw. And security around this movie is just ridiculous. And yeah. We couldn't get our hands on anything. They wouldn't send us anything. And we haven't been able to draw anything from the new movie except the skull. So Anthony and I just actually went to a special press screening this past Sunday.
Oh, you've already seen it?
Yeah.
I hate you. Get off the show. I'm dying to see the new indie movie. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 80s. Indie was the man.
Yep, me too. I actually love Indiana Jones. And it was a pleasure to be able to see it early and get to work on the icons, that's for sure.
You got to give us a little tea. Don't give any spoilers, but did you really enjoy the movie, or was it as good as the other ones? And
I really did enjoy it. It was tough because the entire time I was watching it, the part of my brain was like, would this make a good icon? Would this make a good icon?
Yeah. You know?
So it was like I had to turn that part of me off for trying to just watch it. And I did enjoy it. There's some parts that are, you know, it's going to catch flack. There's a lot of there's a lot more fantasy or science fiction in it than usual.
Well, they had that in the very first movie. I mean, they open up the thing and the power comes out and turns all the Nazis into skeletons
right.
and dust. And,
right.
I mean, that's always been there.
Right.
I think people forget that.
So if you can deal with that stuff, then I think you'll really enjoy it.
I'm definitely going to see that movie.
So for the icons, I mean, will you be starting working on those from memory, or you know, were you able to take any photographs or film from the press screening? I mean, how does that work?
For the new one, now that we've actually attended the screening, they couldn't send us anything prior to that, but now that we've seen it, they can send us assets. So they can send us screen grabs and sketches and all kinds of stuff. Now that the cat is supposedly out of the bag. So we've got some of that stuff from Paramount, and we're working on it now. When it will be out, the last set, I can't say, because I don't know how long it will take to create them. Hopefully in June.
D- Do you do your design work in, like, Illustrator?
Everything is Illustrator, yeah.
Yeah, so it's real easy to scale them up and down then.
Exactly, yeah. We do all the base creation in Illustrator and then bring it into Photoshop for creation in our custom icon builder Photoshop plugin that we wrote.
Now, that's the one that you guys actually released to the general public as well.
That's correct, yeah.
So the tools that you're using to build your own icons, you basically allow anybody to create their own icons using the same tools.
Right. We created it for ourselves initially because we needed a tool that would allow us to create dozens or hundreds of icons quickly and efficiently. And there was nothing like that out there. And so we came up with this filter that allows us to work right out of Photoshop and build icons directly from that. And then we said, well, if we're going to use it for ourselves, other people probably want to be able to have access to it too. And we started selling it.
And it's doing well, I hope?
Oh, yeah, it's doing great. It's actually, I think it's pretty much the de facto standard for creating icons for the Mac. I'm not sure about Windows, but other than interface
Who cares
builder.
About that, though?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So let's go back in time. It's 1996. What was the drive to create the Icon Factory to begin with?
It started as a hobby between myself and two other guys at the Icon Factory, Corey Marion and Talis Choi. And we all happened to be working at the same company together here in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we were doing software, educational software for kids. And part of our job description was to do the little OS 8 and 9 icons on the desktop for CD-ROMs.
Oh, yeah.
And on the side, we were just doing icons for fun. We put them up on AOL, and people started downloading them. And we're like, hey, this would be pretty cool to do, you know. So we formed a little page for it and started doing freelance work on the side. One of our first ones was Microsoft Outlook Express.
Oh, really?
For the Mac. Yep, for Mac OS 9.
I remember that icon.
Yeah, and we did Keychain for OS 9 for Apple. That was another one that we did. And from there, things started to snowball.
When did you realize that this is going to be more than just a hobby? Or have you realized that yet?
Actually, I'm still grappling with that. There's some days I will go into work and I'm like, I can't believe I get paid to do this.
Yeah, this is how am I getting paid for this?
You know, it's
yeah.
just like, you know, but everyone takes them for granted. It's so funny because you see them all the time. They're on your desktop. They're on your cell phone. You know, they're in your car. They're everywhere. Icons are everywhere. And you think about it, someone's got to make them, right?
Yeah, somebody yep. does, and that's a lot of work out there. I mean, there's an icon for every application.
Right, exactly. So, you know, that's what keeps us in business. That's what keeps us paying the bills and stuff. So
how have you guys moved ahead with technology? When Apple comes out with a new release, what do you guys look for in the new operating system that you're going to improve upon?
Well, one of the things we do is, of course, check to see if there are any changes to the system itself, like have they messed with the trash can or folders or, you know, anything like that, because we have Candybar in conjunction with Panic that lets you set those system icons across your entire computer. And we keep an eye on that pretty closely because Apple has a tendency to modify things. They change, like, whether open drop states still work or not, or, you know, if they add a new folder into the home folder and stuff like that. When Leopard came out and they increased the sizes, it was a big deal, you know. But we knew about Leopard sizes for almost a year before Leopard came out.
So you were prepared.
Yeah, we were prepared, and we started, you know, upsizing all of our icon sets and even upsizing client work at the time, or getting ready to upsize it, because we knew as soon as Leopard and Vista came out that they would want to, you know, update their icons to the new technology.
How many hours a day do you actually spend creating icons now?
Me, myself, not many, because I get stuck doing most of the day-to-day running of the business stuff. I really do like to design in as much as possible, but maybe me, I do a couple hours a day. But the guys at the Icon Factory, they spend pretty much all day doing icons.
What's the favorite one that you've ever created yourself, personally?
Oh, geez.
Or do you have just one? Is there like a set that you created that you're especially proud of, or a couple icons?
It changes over time, you know, because when you do one a set, you're like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever done. And then over time, you're like looking back at it like, man, what was I thinking when I did that? You know?
Orange, what was I thinking?
I know, I can't believe I actually drew that piece of crap. And
that doesn't look anything like a fish.
Exactly. You know? I I really still actually am proud of a lot of the icon sets we did for Mac OS 9 way back in the day, because they are, you know, people look at it now and it's like, it's just a little tiny 32 by 32, you know, piece of little artwork. And you were so limited then. You only had 256 colors and there was only so many pixels you could push, you know, into the shape that you were doing. And it was a real art. And today it's a lot less of that. You know, you have this huge canvas and unlimited colors and unlimited anti-aliasing and drop shadows and all this stuff.
Did you guys used to use a lot of ResEdit back in the day?
Yeah, we did. And we used another program called, what was that? Nova Icons or something like that.
I'm sure I used it at the time. I mean, I was kind of into trying to build my own icons. They were always horrible. But, you know, because we had the downloadable edition of the magazine, and of course we had to have an icon for it on the desktop.
Right.
And so I was always trying to create a different icon. Eventually other people did it for me, which was great, because when it comes to actually drawing, I have no artistic ability. But I remember messing with ResEdit, and it was really tricky because you could really damage a program using that program.
Yeah, it was like, danger, danger, Will Robinson, don't open this resource fork.
Absolutely. David?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, I mean, obviously you do icons for Windows now as well as Mac. I mean, is it easy nowadays to do, because Windows icons in the past always used to be, in my mind anyway, always a bit behind Mac icons. You know, the Mac always looked, they always looked very stylish and you could always clearly understand what they were, and there was a lot of Windows icons that really looked really terrible. So how is it?
Or it didn't represent what the program actually did.
Yeah, so how is it now designing for, you know, Windows as well?
It's come a long way since then. I mean, with the release of Vista, you can do everything in Vista that you can do in Leopard. I mean, the size is slightly smaller. It's 256 instead of 512. But for all intents and purposes, it's the same.
Right.
So, I mean, working on a Vista icon versus a Mac icon is very, very similar now. I mean, we both create them in Adobe Illustrator. They both end up coming into Photoshop, and they both get built with Icon Builder. So the only difference between them is the rendering style, the perspective, the lighting,
right,
the palettes.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's a particular skill in designing, you know, an icon that's going to be shrunk down to a small size as opposed to sort of more conventional graphics artwork?
Oh, definitely. I've heard illustrators say that, you know, compared to doing just a plain old illustration, icons are really, really hard. You have to be able to simplify. You have to be able to remove details selectively, increase line weight. You know, it's a challenge to get stuff looking just as good as it can possibly be at 512 by 512 pixels as it is at 16 by 16 pixels.
Yeah.
Where do you start? Do you start at the 512, or do you start at more of a full-size screen and then scale it down and start adjusting line weight and that sort of thing?
We used to start small and scale up, but it's much easier now to start large and go down. It's really a process of, let's pack as much as we can or much as we want in the large one, and then just remove and remove and remove and simplify and simplify and get it down to its base shapes, its base communication, you know, the core idea of what it's going to look like when it's 32 by 32 or 16 by 16.
Is working with a dock for icons, is that a challenge? Because I know Apple's changed the dock. Now it's kind of a 3D thing with Leopard. Before it was more of a 2D. Is that a challenge for you guys?
It is, and the dock has presented a bunch of challenges because the dock is dynamic and it casts shadows, you know. The icon just doesn't sit on the dock. It's also got its light source. It casts a dynamic shadow. It's got these running lights, you know, the whole deal. So when you design a drop shadow on your icon, you have to take into consideration, how is that going to combine with the shadow in the dock? You know, it's really thrown a monkey into the wrench, I think, with this dock design that Apple's done.
Do you like it better? I mean, obviously, I think icons have come a long way over the last 10, 15 years. You mentioned System 8. System 9. I thought those were the ugliest, most generic, boring Apple icons of all time. It was worse than System 8, I thought. But is it a lot more exciting for you guys?
Yeah, I totally love designing for Mac OS X. You have a lot of freedom, and you know, depending on what the client wants, obviously, you can do pretty much anything. You know, but then you go from the extremes where you have like the Adobe Creative Suite of icons, where it's two letter forms in a solid color square.
So ugly.
You know, and then you go from that to, you know, super realistic, ultra rendered, you know, like an Apple icon on the desktop, like GarageBand or iTunes.
I like kind of fun icons, like the one for Comic Life. That's a fun one. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's colorful. It sticks out more than, you know, the Microsoft Office icons do now, or especially the well, no, actually, I got to say the Adobe icons really do kind of pop out because they're so simple, but they're so boring by the same time. I mean, Photoshop, to me, the icon for Photoshop should still be the eye. Do you agree?
I think everyone initially says that. You know, it's like everyone fears change. I mean, to some degree, you know, and even us, we criticized the Adobe Creative Suite icons when they came out, and even to some degree now, I still don't like them. I mean, I love the simplicity and their ease of, you know, communication on the dock, but at the same time, if you don't know what PS is or FL or whatever, just by looking at it, then they don't do their job of communicating what they are. So there's a trade-off there. There's simplifying, but they're also cryptic to a degree. And when you have 10 or 15 of them in the dock, all next to each other, it's horrible.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. At least Microsoft kind of represents what they are just by the letter. And I know Adobe tried to do that with, you know, the DW for Dreamweaver and the PS for Photoshop, but I don't know. It's two windows for me. I mean, those letters represent, you know, the suffix at the end of the file name. Right. I don't like that myself.
Well, plus you also, I mean, as soon as you roll your cursor over the icon, you know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it says Adobe Photoshop.
Well, I think most people probably use the dock. They put something in their dock, and it stays in the same spot. So when you're using the dock, you're probably going by memory and, okay, this application for me anyways, like my Timbuktu icon is always the first one right after the Finder icon. Then I have system preferences, then, you know, that sort of thing. I know where it's at.
You have muscle memory about where things are in the UI, and and that does help a lot with, you know, finding the thing that you're after. Another thing that people, you know, don't think about a lot is that the icon in the dock is really a company's first approach to you with branding their product.
Oh, absolutely. The first thing I noticed, a program I just used over the weekend for the first time, Pulp Motion Advanced. It's like an orange sitting in this race car with a big jet engine on it. It's very unique. I haven't seen an icon quite like that before that came stock from a company that, you know, it wasn't part of an icon factory pack that I picked up myself.
Mm-hmm. A good example of this is the Firefox icon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that icon is now pretty much understood as this is Firefox. You know, it's completely different from, you know, anything else where it's like, this is the brand.
That's right.
Particular thing.
In fact, I was looking at some of the Mozilla icons today. The Firefox is very recognizable, but I always find the Thunderbird icon, to me, never. I mean, you're talking about visibility, and to me, the Thunderbird icon, which is meant to be a bird wrapped around a globe, to me, whenever I see it, it doesn't look like that to me. Maybe it's something to do with the way my head is wired, and I've always thought. I've never understood why the Firefox icon works so well, and yet that one doesn't, certainly in my mind, just doesn't work at all.
Yeah, it's kind of a dichotomy between the two, definitely.
Yeah.
Our friend John Hood is the one that designed those icons, and I think he did an outstanding job with Firefox. And
It's unique, that's for sure.
It is. It totally is, and you know, they got a really great asset when they had him design that icon.
So are icon artists, are you kind of like a community, you know, do you all know each other from the different companies?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, we're all familiar with each other's work, and we keep tabs on what other people are doing. I know icon artists in Europe and in Asia. I don't, you know, follow them specifically, but a lot fewer of them have actual personal websites now where they distribute stuff than they used to. There used to be a lot more freeware icon artists out there than there are now.
A lot more. Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, it used to be if if you did a search for Mac icons on the internet, you would just get page after page after page.
Right.
You do it now, and you find the Icon Factory right at the top. Actually, you guys were almost always the first in a Google search, or back in the day in Alta Vista search. So the Icon Factory was always high on that. But there was always so many other websites as well that had, you know, screen pictures that you could download, and much more of a community feel than I think exists today outside of the Icon Factory.
Yeah, I agree with that. We've lost some of that, I think. And I'm not sure exactly why that's happened. I mean, a good place to go is like macthemes.net. That's a good example of some place you can still go to look that up, or pixelgirlpresents.com. Those two places both still offer tons of GUI goodies that Mac users can download and share. And a lot of it is on DeviantArt now, too. Not Mac-specific, but...
Yeah.
Is there some icon... Oh, go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, I think one reason for that is that Apple is you know, they're almost using their own interface as a brand now, particularly with the Apple stores. You know, you go in there and there's just pictures of OS X everywhere. And I think, you know, certainly among the Switcher community, I think people... they tend to stick with what Apple gives them, and then maybe they're not as inclined to sort of rebrand or rebrash the desktop as maybe they used to be. I mean, I know I'm sat in front of a machine running here Leopard, and I've still got the same default Leopard background that comes, you know, when the thing installs, and I've got all the same system icons, you know, and I don't often think about changing them, and maybe that's why, you know, maybe it's just the older school who are more into changing things up, or maybe just people don't realize it can be done.
I agree with that. I think you hit at something there, because, you know, if it's good or if you like it, why change it? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people like the way OS X looks, you know, and they have no need to customize it or go looking, or even know, like you're saying, a switcher coming from Windows or something, they may not even know they can change it.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing in the Mac OS that says customize this icon. You know, obviously, unless you're curious about it, or, you know, you're into that kind of stuff, you may not even know about it. So I agree with you.
So you guys started out as an icon factory, an icon creation website, but you guys are a lot more than that now. You guys have software that you guys have written and you sell, and you give some of it away, and some of it is becoming quite popular, like Twitterific. I mean, that's a huge program now.
Yeah, it's really strange how that's worked, but this little tiny app we did for ourselves, again, because we like Twitter, but we hate going to the website.
I agree.
You know, we were like, we need something to be able to post to this service, but we don't want to go to the web, so Greg wrote Twitterific, and now it's our most popular application.
I love the little bird icon for Twitterific, by the way.
Thanks.
Is this something that you guys are going to port to an iPhone when that comes out, or is that something you don't want to talk about yet?
No, we're porting it, and I'm happy to talk about it. Craig's
had a feeling.
Yeah, Craig's been working on it for months, and we actually just finished it and submitted it to the Apple Design Awards for WWDC.
Uh-huh.
So it's done. But for all intents and purposes, it is done, and there'll be some bug fixes and some additional tweaks to it before it goes live, whenever that is, for the App Store. We still don't have any information about that, obviously.
What's the iPhone going to do for your business?
Good question. No idea yet. It's all a big unknown. You know, I mean, we've, just like every other Apple iPhone developer, we're kind of in the dark until, you know, Apple decides to say something about how this is all going to work. I mean, they've vaguely outlined it, but they haven't gone into any specifics about...
Now, what's Twitterific going to be? How much is that going to cost for the iPhone user?
I can't even say. I don't even know yet. It may be free, it may cost, we don't know.
Well, I know Apple's going to keep 30%, and I know there was some stink about that. I didn't think that was a very bad price, but then again, I don't write software. Do you think earning 70% per sale is a good deal for you guys?
Oh, yeah, for sure, because considering all of the hosting fees, the bandwidth costs, the...
processing money.
Yeah, exactly, the bank, you know, service charges for credit card transactions, all of that stuff. Xbox Live titles... Xbox and Microsoft takes 50% of all of those transactions.
Crazy.
You know, and Apple's letting us keep 70%. So,
and it's a captive audience. I mean, the store's going to be right there on the device. You click it and boom, you're good to go.
Right, assuming you know, there's still a question about, are you going to be able to buy an app over the air, or do you have to be on Wi-Fi, or, you know, or what? I have a sneaking suspicion that once the 3G phone is announced, and we hear more about the App Store, that you'll probably be able to buy apps right over the air. So I
think that's a little different than, I know Apple's having discussions with the music industry because they want more money for the ability to purchase a song over the carrier's network as opposed to a Wi-Fi network. They want more money for that. I don't know why they think they deserve that, but that's the discussions going on. I can't see anybody complaining about someone using the network to buy applications on the iPhone. It's just more people using their network, which is really what they want.
Exactly. I would think so. And for developers, that is fantastic. Imagine sitting in a doctor's office waiting for an appointment, and you're browsing through the App Store, and you find a game that you like. You go ahead and you buy it, you download it, and you can start playing it right away.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. I mean, I have an iPhone, and to be able to go in and just purchase something right there. I've done it a few times with the music store, but the problem there is if I'm on a Wi-Fi network, I'm probably at home. It's much easier to browse the iTunes store on the computer than it is on the iPhone.
Right.
But when it comes to applications for the iPhone, I think it's going to be perfect right there.
Yeah,
right?
But still there's a lingering question about, you know, okay, so you can browse the store while you're sitting there in the doctor's office. Can you try the app for free?
Yeah, is there going to be demos available?
Yeah. Will there be a demo, or do you have to actually go and buy it first? You know, these aren't questions we don't have answers to yet. So,
are you expecting those answers at WWDC?
I think so. I would love to have them. I know almost all the other developers we've spoken to want those answers as well. And I think that, you know, if they're going to launch it anytime soon, they need to provide additional information about how that's going to work.
From a developer's perspective, do you want people to be able to download it for free, try it for, I don't know, a couple days, and then decide if they're going to buy it or not? And if they don't, it's just automatically deleted.
Yeah, I mean, how can you know what Twitterific is like unless you can try a demo of it?
Yeah,
you
know? Absolutely.
So, you know, there has to be a way to be able to do that, especially with a game. You know, you don't know a game. How do you know a game you're going to like if you want to buy it unless you can try it first?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. There's been a lot of media coverage as of late, at least as far as the PS3 is concerned, that a demo does not automatically mean more people are going to buy your game. I would suggest otherwise. I mean, I never would have bought Crackdown if there wasn't a demo. I never would have bought Saints Row if there wasn't a demo. But there was a demo. I tried it. I loved it. I went and bought the game. But sales figures suggest that just because there's a demo does not necessarily translate into higher sales. Do you think that's true with computers as well? Or? Just a different market.
What about a video demo, though? Maybe you're not an actual working demo, but at least you can watch a video of the game in action.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
Yeah,
because if it's a timed demo, it's really going to fall back to the developers to create not only the full application but the demo code. You know, you can only do this much before it expires, and you have to pay
for
it.
Right, and I think that is something that Apple wants to avoid at all costs.
I would imagine.
Yeah, they don't want to have to deal with registration codes or, you know, any type of additional user input in order to use an application.
So how do you reconcile that with a game? I mean, if it's a simple game and they give you, say, a couple days to use it before you have to pay for it, don't you think that a lot of people are going to play these simple games and, oh, that was fun, and, you know, I'm not going to pay for it?
It's an excellent question. It's a big what if that's just hanging out there. You know, one of the things we've been speculating is, okay, Apple might give us the ability to put two versions of the app in the App Store. One is a demo one that automatically expires after a certain amount of time, and the other is the real one that you go and buy.
That you click some button in the demo, and then the Apple Store just knows, okay, they're buying this, and it downloads the full version automatically?
Maybe. You know, that's just a guess.
Yeah, maybe a separate app that you go and say, okay, well, this one's expired, now I go and get the real one.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm. See, I mean, with Twitterific, you've got a dual business model, because obviously you have a paid-for version that's ad-free, but you also have an ad-supported version. How has that worked for you? And, you know, are you seeing a lot of conversion between the ad version and the paid version?
It's been great. I mean, initially, we weren't even going to have a paid version. We were just going to have the free version with just the ads. You know, and when we beta tested it, all the beta testers said, I'll pay you money to get rid of these ads.
Yeah. You
know, I'll pony up right now if I don't have to look at ads.
Yeah.
So we went and said, okay, sure, we'll do that. And we created this version where you can, you know, donate some money and then you eliminate the ads. And it's worked great. You know, people who don't want to pay for it don't have to. And they get an ad every hour. And it's not just any ad. They're the deck ads. They're very targeted and they're designed well. They're not intrusive. And they're actually for things that Mac users like.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've worked really well in that regard, and we've got actually a lot of positive feedback about the ads. I still run Twitterific without the registration code because I like seeing the ads. You know, they show upcoming conferences and software that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
So,
what's Xscope?
Xscope is a tool that we developed with a partner in Austria. His name is Wolfgang Ant, and he runs Artist Software. We did Xscope and Frensic with him. Xscope is a tool for designers and developers to help them measure anything on the screen instantly, really. Yeah, there's a tool in Xscope called Dimensions. It's brand new to version 2 where you can just turn it on, roll your mouse over anything on the screen, and it will automatically look for pixel edges of any image or block or margin, text, anything, and it'll tell
you. Very useful for designers.
Exactly, and for developers, too, because they want to find out how big buttons are or anything like that.
David?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it looks like a really good app. One thing that impresses me about all your offerings is, you know, they're all very high quality, they're all very focused, and, you know, they're all small apps that do a single thing, but, you know, I mean, they all get really good write-ups, you know, 4 or 5 stars from all the reviewers and everything like that. I mean, is quality control and you know, a very focused app on knows exactly what it wants to do, is that really what you try and deliver?
As much as possible. I mean, we're all pretty much perfectionists. I hate to say it. You know, sometimes it gets really old to be able to sit there and say and worry about how something looks or behaves so much. You know, it can put us behind sometimes. At Xscope, you know, we were just like frustrated about, you know, how something wasn't exactly working the way we thought it should work, and we spent extra time to get it to be like that. But it pays off in the end because people appreciate it and it adds up to a higher quality piece of software. Thanks for the compliments. It means a lot to us, actually, because even though we do it for our living, it really is just really for fun for us. You know, can't imagine doing anything else. I love the software side as much as the icon side. And I haven't really enjoyed doing like the user interfaces for Frensic and Xscope. So it means a lot to hear such kind compliments coming from people like you guys.
One of the things that I always ask our guests, usually a couple questions. First one was, when did you get into computers?
In middle school, I would say 86.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It was something you had to use in school, and you kind of...
Well, actually, that's not true. Really I started it before that. I had an Apple IIe back when I was in grade school. And
I think a lot of us had those. Dads brought them home.
Yeah,
and
played Choplifter and Load Runner and a bunch of other games, Ultima and Bard's Tale. And then I took basic programming in middle school, and my parents made me take a typing class, and I thought, why am I ever going to need typing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. I had the same class in middle school. It was actually it was junior high for us. It was actually mandatory, and I failed it. And I can guarantee you right now I could smoke anybody that was in that class, including the teacher, in typing.
Right. And I look back on it now, I'm like, thank you, Mom and Dad, for making me take that class. You know?
Yeah, you ever notice that the older you get, the smarter your parents become?
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
It's funny how that works, doesn't
it? It is.
So what was your favorite Mac of all time? Not including the ones you have right now.
My Newton.
Your Newton? You like the Newton a lot.
Yeah, I love my Newton. I remember when I first got it, I was like, I'm going to take this and I'm going to put my grocery store list on. I'm going to bring it to the grocery store, and you know, and it's going to be so much better than a pad of paper. And
It's not,
but I mean, at the time, it was cool, you know. It was like,
you know,
this huge, bulky thing. I look at it now, and I'm like, I can't believe I carted that thing around everywhere I went.
I bought myself a Message Pad 2100 about 2.5 years ago. I absolutely loved that thing, and it did literally go everywhere with me. And I actually took it to a store one day, and I had a list of items I was buying on it, and when I went out to the parking lot, I left the message pad in the shopping cart and drove home. And of course, I went back, and this, you know, I bought it off eBay, and this thing was in absolutely pristine condition. It was absolutely fantastic. Of course, I went back to the store when I got home, realized I'd left it behind, and it was gone. And
actually, they were using it to keep the door open.
No, it's such an awful story.
Yeah, no, it was truly sad.
That is very sad. His name's Gideon Mayhew. He's one of the principals and a designer, and he kind of runs the whole company, it sounds like to me, of the Icon Factory. Check out their Indiana Jones icons. Those are really, really cool. I'm downloading. Actually, I already downloaded them.
Yeah. And if you're interested,
how long are you guys going to have the whole indie motif going on the main website?
It'll be up through June. I'm not sure if it'll stay up all the way through Crystal Skull's set release, but we'll see. It depends on how long it takes to get that out. It'll be up a couple more weeks for sure.
Okay, and if you're into Twitter, then Twitterific is definitely the app you want. If you know, once you get into Twitter, you've got to be checking it regularly to make sure what you're doing and what your friends are up to. And Twitterific, I found, is absolutely the best way of doing it.
Absolutely, no question.
Thank you.
Do you want to throw out your Twitter handle?
Yeah, it's just Gideon, GEDEON. Pretty straightforward and simple. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's twitter.com/Gideon.
We're going to take a break. We're going to listen to John Nemo's segment, and then we're going to come back. We're going to have the winner of our contest from last week, and I think we're going to try calling the winner. I've already got his name. It's going to be, I think I'll save that for the next break here. Gideon, we want to thank you very much for coming on the podcast this week. Hopefully a lot of people will go up and check out your software offerings, the icons, and everybody will jump on Twitter and start following you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And David and I are back. We're supposed to go to John Nemo's All Over the Mac segment this time, but it looks like the MP3 file, David, got corrupt somehow.
Got nibbled on by the internet gremlins on his way to his big job.
He actually sent a couple in advance, and for some reason I'm unable to play them in QuickTime or import them into GarageBand. So John's listening to this right now going, "Doh!" So anyways, you know, we talked to Gideon off the air, David, and turns out he's going to be starting, if he hasn't already, his own podcast.
Yes, he's going to be talking with a friend about science fiction. We had quite an interesting conversation with him, and hopefully he's going to send us a promo for that so we can play it in the show and send people over to him.
Absolutely, because it sounds fun. I'm going to subscribe to it myself. You know, I love science fiction, although the problem, he said they're talking about Battlestar Galactica Season 4 right now. I haven't been watching it. I've been kind of waiting till Battlestar Galactica finishes its entire run, then I was going to have kind of a marathon couple months and watch all of them. So I don't want any spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot happening in the final season because it's the last season before they move to, I think they've got a spin-off series coming out later on after they finish this season. So you probably will want to hold off on that. I'm about 2 or 3 episodes in so far, and it's looks like there's an awful lot going to happen this season. So you won't want to spoilers.
I know it's a good show. I haven't watched it myself.
Yeah.
Last week we had a contest thanks to Sam Levin's Cool Mac Picks. Sam hooked up with Scotty Vest, and they agreed to give away one of their $120 essential jackets.
Yep, 19 pockets and compartments for your gadgets. As I mentioned last week, I have a couple of Scotty Vest products. They're very popular in the tech community, and with good reason. They really are fantastic jackets. So who got picked as a lucky winner?
Well, we had more entries for this than I've had entries for almost any contest. I mean, not all of them, of course. I mean, some of them were contests for Adobe CS2. That was huge, and Microsoft Office. That was a big one. But I didn't know what to expect with this concert because we're giving away a jacket.
Mm.
Yeah, I didn't know if there's going to be a lot of crossover, but man, we've got a lot. I mean, I'm talking, it must be over 300 entries for this contest.
Wow.
So that's quite a bit.
Yeah.
This week, randomly selected on my email box is Mark Pace from Pensacola, Florida. Maybe I shouldn't have said he's from Pensacola, that way you know, any thieves listening to the show doesn't know to go to Pensacola, Florida, track him down and steal his jacket. That would not be
well,
good.
You know what? If they do steal his jacket, they won't find in half the stuff he's got in there. He's got that many pockets. You know, you can find, if you put the thing on and 6 months later you find, oh, where's that camera gone? Oh, here it is.
Well, I didn't know I had that stick of gum still. Wow, that's cool.
Exactly, yeah.
Just when I needed it. So here's the thing. I can't make a phone call to an outside line in Skype and continue to talk with you at the same time, David. So I'm going to put your call on hold, and I'm going to try to telephone him with the phone number that he provided and let him know he won. So we're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to hopefully be back with our winner, Mark Pace. And then after that, we'll be back with you, David. So hold tight.
Okay. All right.
This is Mark.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Good. Who's this?
This is Tim Robertson with the MyMac Podcast.
Oh, hey, Tim. How can I help you?
Well, I wanted to call you and let you know you won our contest this week for the Scotty Vest's Essential Jacket.
No way.
Yeah, you are the winner, Mark.
Hey, that's cool.
I'm actually recording you right now for the podcast, so you're going to hear yourself on show 185.
All right.
So is this something that you can actually use?
Oh, you know I can. As a matter of fact, I was out this week looking around town for things like that, yeah, I'll definitely be loading the pockets with gadgets.
It's a $120 value, and I take it you want the black one. I think that's what you have in your email.
Yeah, black would be good.
Cool. Well, you are the winner, Mark. Hopefully you'll find a lot of use for the coat. Thanks a lot to Scotty Vest for supplying us with this coat, and hopefully we'll, maybe have another contest and get you something else in the future, Mark.
Well, that would be great. I appreciate the contribution to your podcast, and I appreciate the eVest.
Hey, what kind of computer do you use?
I have a G4 iBook.
A G4 iBook?
Uh-huh.
How long have you had that, since it was brand new?
No, actually, I just bought that not long ago. My first experience with a Mac was last year. I bought a G3 iBook just to learn how the silly thing worked. And it was only a 500 megahertz iBook. I got a real great indoctrination in the Mac, but it was slow and didn't really quite keep up the way I needed it to, so I sold it. And just a month or so ago, I found a real good deal on a G4 iBook that had Leopard preloaded on it, and so I'm getting back in the fray and playing around.
What do you like about the Mac? I mean, was there any one thing that appealed to you when you got into it?
Well, the thing, even last year when I played with that one of the things that I liked the best was the inherent security that was built into the Mac OS.
Yeah, it's kind of nice to be able to browse the internet without worrying about getting a virus or getting hijacked.
Well, not only that, but just the physical security of, if you travel and take something with you, it's nice to have something like, drive encryption actually built into the OS, and that works, pretty flawlessly.
Did you come from the PC world then?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, I can't lie, my other computer is still a PC, but after Vista crashing on me 3 times, it makes you want to look around a little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, actually. Now, does the new Intel machines kind of appeal to you? That way you can have the best of both worlds. You can have a PC and a Mac in one box?
They do, and the biggest reason when I bought my last PC laptop, the reason I didn't buy a Mac then was because I was really looking for something that supported tablet functionality, and a lot of the things that I was doing in school required drawing diagrams and notes and things that really made the tablet made easier, and that was the one thing. If Apple had a tablet version out of their MacBook, I probably would have bought it. So next time.
Maybe. You never know.
That's
of course,
what I keep hoping. I know they're listening to us, right?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I hope so anyways. And if they are, send an advertising check because we could use the money.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, congratulations on winning the Scotty Vest jacket. It looks like a cool jacket. I kind of want one myself. They didn't offer me one.
See, every giveaway should come with two. Isn't that the way it works?
Yeah, well, at least two. We've got a lot of other co-hosts. I'm sure they would like some of these goodies as well. But you sound like a good guy. I'm glad we can get you this, man.
Well, I appreciate it. I can't. I, I, I am overwhelmed tonight, and I'm truly grateful.
We will actually have the company, they will send it directly to you. If you don't get it within a couple weeks, let me know, and I'll sick the pit bulls on them.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Congratulations, Mark.
Thanks again, sir, and I look forward to hearing the next issue of your podcast.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So we got a winner this week, David, and we actually got to talk to him on the phone. At least I did. That was pretty cool.
Excellent. It's always good to speak to him in person.
You know, who was it? I think it was Rich Lefko was one of our winners for a contest, and that's how he got involved with MyMac.com. So
yeah.
It's kind of twofold. We give stuff away, which is always good. Hopefully we get more listeners because people, yeah, well, I can get something for free on that show.
Yeah.
We bribe them. Yeah. But, you know, we get to meet other Mac users that when else am I going to have an opportunity to meet someone that lives in this case, Florida? I'm never going to meet that person, most likely, in person. So
no.
It's kind of nice to be able to talk to them on the phone, find out how they're using their computers, what computer they're using, and, you know, to give something away, that's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. It's always good to engage directly with the people who support the website and support the podcast. And, you know, it's nice to get to meet people, and we've all got a common interest, and it's really good.
So, again, congratulations to Mark Pace. And, you know, this jacket looks really cool. I really want one myself. Maybe I'll fork over the money eventually. Just not right now.
Yeah, one thing I would say, actually, I found, you know, if anybody is interested in Scotty Vest stuff, is go up to the website and buy something, because once you're on their mailing list as a customer, they will send you some fantastic offers. They normally, at least once or twice a year, they'll have a real fire sale, you know, if they're updating things. And if you're on their mailing list, they will send you some fantastic bargains. The jacket that I bought, recently, the rodeo jacket, I got for half price because I was a previous customer of theirs. So
awesome.
I would encourage the listeners, if you do like the sound of the Scotty Vest stuff, then go up and maybe have a look. I've got a couple of the t-shirts I wear on my bike. It's just got room in the shoulder of the t-shirt there's a little pocket there you can put an iPod shuffle or something in, and then route the cables up to the neck for your headphones, and you know, things like that are pretty cheap, and it'll get you on the mailing list, and then you'll get access to the sales. So I would recommend them.
Good to know. Speaking of buying stuff, we do have a sponsor of the show, and we encourage our listeners to go up and check them out. It's Otherworld Computing.
Yeah.
This week, David, you picked a product that you wanted to talk about a little bit from Otherworld.
I did, and I think this really, you know, when we talked to them a few weeks ago, one of the things that came across to me was really, you know, how they're a kind of, you know, a real supporter of the community, and this product, I think, really sort of exemplifies that. What I'm going to talk about is something called the Ex Post Facto, and what that is basically it's an open source application that allows you to install versions of OS 10 onto or OS 9 even onto machines that Apple don't officially support.
Mm-hmm. So they're more powerful. They're a lot of those machines are much more powerful than you really need to be able to run OS 10.
Well, exactly. And the thing is that, you know, different levels of performance mean different things to different people. If you've got an older machine, so I don't know, say an old Wall Street PowerBook, you know, it's a 4 or 5 year old machine. You know, if you want to give that to a student or you just use it for a bit of web browsing or checking your email or just leave it up as a file server, something like that, but you want a later version of OS 10 on it, then it will do that job fine, even though it has a slower processor. The problem is that, you know, Apple has its support limits for OS 10, and as you move on through the versions, you'll find that... you know, you can't install the later versions of OS X on. Ex Post Facto is a software product that's written by a guy called Ryan Rempel, and he is supported by Otherworld Computing, and they offer this product through their website. It's it's open source, so it's free, though they have a registration if you want to throw them a donation for further development. And what this will do is you basically will allow you to install, if your machine only supports officially, you say, 10.2 Jaguar, then it will allow you to install possibly 10.3 Panther or even 10.4 Tiger onto it. You know, obviously your mileage may vary. But if you've got an older Mac, particularly one of the desktop Macs, and you want to put some extra RAM and hard drive in there and then run a later version of OS 10, then Ex Post Facto is a free way of allowing you to do that.
We also are joined by Lee Gibbons. We're getting a little feedback from you, Lee.
Oh, a little feedback?
A little feedback.
Oh, let me see if I can adjust some stuff here.
How's that?
That sounds a little bit
better, I think. Yep, yeah. Definitely. So we were talking about Otherworld Computing, our sponsor, obviously, and the ability to run a later version of OS X on an older machine that's not officially supported. Have you done anything like that?
Well, I've actually been going the opposite direction. I've been trying to get I've been using a couple of different emulators like Sheepshaver and stuff to get OS 9 running on my Intel Macs.
Ooh, good luck
so,
with that.
So I'm just looking for something that works nicely. But, yeah, I actually have not spent too much time. Yeah, I was listening to David talk about ex post facto. I took a look at it really quick, but we had someone at the office was trying to do something, but I never got into it too far. So,
yeah, well,
yeah, and there's a lot of people out there that have older machines that they probably like to repurpose, and this would possibly be a good solution for them.
Yeah, it looks really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's not perfect. It doesn't work for every machine. And they have, if you go to the website, there'll be a link in the show notes. They have a long list of supported systems on there. But certainly, if you've got an older tower or even some of the older PowerBooks, then they will help you get some of the later versions of OS X. Not Leopard. They don't support Leopard. Leopard's probably a jump too far for these older machines. The other thing to bear in mind is that. Up until Leopard, when every time you moved up a version with OS X, the performance actually increased because they were optimizing their code. So if you have, say, a machine running 10.2 Jaguar and it's not particularly fantastic, then if you go to Panther or Tiger, you may find you actually get better performance than you might expect. And obviously, Otherworld Computing offer a variety of upgrades you can put into these machines, like RAM and hard drives, interface cards for discs and video and that sort of thing. So you've got an opportunity. If you've got an old cheap machine that sat around doing nothing, don't necessarily think that it has to go to the scrapyard. You might be able to spend a little bit of money on upgrading it and then use ex post facto to get a newer, more modern version of OS X on that and really extend the life of it. And I think that's quite a fun thing to do.
Yeah, and it's definitely worth looking into if you do have that an older machine like that. We actually got a call this week, and I want to play that. Did you get that sound file that I sent you, Lee?
Yeah, I got it. I haven't had a chance to play it yet.
Okay, well, I'm going to play it here on the show, and we'll be right back.
Hey, Tim. This is Mike Breed. I'm the host of the Let's Get Down to Earth Science Podcast, and I'm an earth science teacher at Shenango Valley High School in Binghamton, New York. And I decided I wanted to call the show to ask you a couple of questions. I'm a very frequent grant writer for my classroom. As you probably can suspect, schools aren't all that dependable on funding our efforts, especially those in the technology fields, because it's very expensive, and districts are always trying to make cuts to appease the taxpayers, understandably. So I read a lot of grants, and my most recent grant that I was awarded was for my students and I to make a video production for Regents Review for Earth Science. And just as a little note, the Regents are New York State end-of-the-year tests to make sure students understand all the core curricula and the concepts that they need to understand to pass the whole class in New York State. So anyways, we're going to make a video. The kids are going to be assigned a different unit throughout the year, and they're going to make a video segment with tips on doing better on the Regents exam. And at the end of the year, we're going to put it all together in a much bigger video with some transitions and whatnot. So my grant is for, at least at this time, a MacBook Pro laptop, Final Cut Express software, a dot Mac subscription, a Canon ZR930 camcorder, and a bunch of other ancillary things like a battery and some tapes and things like that. So I guess my question is, really, which Mac do you think would be the best? I mean, I picked the MacBook Pro because it has a video card in it, although, the grant's for about $2,500. I could get a MacBook Air. It's really cool. The kids would like it a lot. But I'm wondering, does it have the horsepower necessary to run a program like Final Cut Express or just create a video in general? So any thoughts you have would be great. I listen to the show every week. I think the show is great. And if you guys out there are listening, I wholeheartedly encourage you to support the show. Click that donate link on their website. So, again, this is Mike Breed, and I appreciate any feedback you might have. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the feedback, Mike, and the question. Let's jump over to David first. What do you think about, that's a lot of money, I think, for a school to invest in some recording equipment, including a computer. He talked about the MacBook Air. I think you know where I stand on that when it comes to video recording and editing.
The word I've heard from, I know a couple of people have the Air, and they say that actually performance-wise, it's not too bad. But what I would say is that really for the source of project he's talking about, I'm not sure the advantages the Air has, which are, you know, principally, you know, that real light and thin profile, are going to be advantages that he's going to, you know, realize, because there's a
bigger problem.
Just about to come onto that. I mean, you know, while Final Cut Express will probably run on that machine, he's not likely to be doing that editing out in the field. He's going to be doing that back at base, so he's not really going to get any advantage from the portability. And of course, that portability has introduced compromises. It only has one USB port and no FireWire port. And if he's,
right, how are you going to get the video from the camera?
Yeah, exactly.
To the computer, you're going to have to import it with another computer and then copy it over to that.
That's
machine.
Right.
Or not an ideal solution.
No, not at all. So really, the Air is probably not something that he would want to look at. What I would suggest is really his decision would come down between the MacBook Pro or a MacBook. You know, either machine should be able to run Final Cut Express fine. I know the MacBook Pro obviously has a dedicated graphics card, but that's not really something that Final Cut Express really needs. I mean, Final Cut Express...
No, they're not going to be doing any 3D rendering or anything like that, just some transitions and straight video editing. Lee, do you think that the MacBook... And the MacBook Pro, do you think the MacBook Pro offers any real-world advantages for simple, you know, video editing with Final Cut?
The one thing I think you probably get a little benefit out of if you got the MacBook Pro, if they ever wanted to, you know, of course the attachments, you know, being able to put FireWire 800, 400, and also using the Express card slot to connect up some eSATA drives. But the other benefit, I have to take a look a little closer, but I think I've been a Final Cut Pro user since 1.0. And I know
this is Express.
With Express, so I wonder if you could take advantage of some of the GPU graphic rendering for the extreme, you know, when you're doing your video rendering.
But in an education setting, I don't think that shaving maybe 10 minutes off of some video editing is really going to be worth another $1,000.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, with a MacBook, I think he's perfectly fine running Final Cut Express. I mean, it supports the AVC HD on the new cameras and all that stuff, so...
Yeah. About the only drawback between picking up a MacBook and a MacBook Pro, screen size for one.
Yeah.
But you can hook up an external monitor to the MacBook as well. But more than that is it has you can put a lot less memory in the MacBook as you can with the MacBook Pro.
I don't think that's true, no. I think, I mean, I've got the previous generation MacBook before they went to the Penryn processor, and I've got 4 gig in mine. So, I mean... Really,
and 4 gigs going to be more than sufficient
definitely.
For what they're using.
So I mean, I would say take a long look at it. But you know, my inclination would be to buy two basic MacBooks because then he gets two machines rather than one. And you know, for the $2,500, he could probably do that and probably have some change left over to maybe buy a couple of extra monitors as well.
I would even suggest looking at the last generation of the MacBook.
Yeah.
Rather than the brand new one, you're going to save another. Especially if you bought two, you're going to save like $500-$600.
Yeah.
You could really get a couple machines. You could really stretch that money a long way and pick up more than you probably bought.
Yeah, that's a good idea. If you have two machines, boy, the workflow is just amazingly quick. You could have someone working on titling, someone could working on edits. It's really nice.
Now, the problem with that is they're going to need multiple versions of Final Cut Express, and that's going to up the price a little bit, but I think it'd probably be worthwhile to pick up two machines rather than the MacBook Pro. Yep. So that's our advice, Mike. Of course, everybody go check out Let's Get Down to Earth Science podcast. I actually listened to that a few times. Really, really well done, especially if you have kids like I do. I have 13-year-old girls. I have younger kids too, so they're not interested at all. The 4-year-old's like, oh, turn that off, it's hurting my ears. But my older kids, obviously, they don't want to listen to something that sounds like a classroom. But if it's a podcast and I'm listening to it, they can't tell me to turn it off. And heaven forbid they sit there and listen and actually learn something. Anyways, let's jump over to the next topic. What is going to be the next topic? I don't have any big thing to talk about other than what's going on the website right now and what's going on in your computer lives. Let's start with Lee. What's going on with you right now?
Well, right now, I actually am delving into high-definition video. I went out and picked up a new camera. We do a video thing for the preschool my daughter goes to every year. We do a sort of end-of-the-year video thing. But we have a different volunteer woman who wants to handle it this year, so I'm getting prepared for next year. And what I'm trying to do is figure out what's the best workflow for AVCHD. And right now, it's kind of limited on the Mac right now.
It is.
I was a little surprised.
That's going to change, but yeah, I'm a little surprised about that too.
Because I was looking into Final Cut and iMovie 08 and Final Cut Express. And the only solution right now is it translates the AVCHD into Apple Intermediate Codec. And then you have to figure out how to get back onto AVCHD, which is something I haven't figured out yet. So I'm waiting on some native AVCHD support.
Why are you going with that format? Is there an advantage to that you see there rather than the standard HD cameras that are out there?
Well, if you play it back in most Blu-ray devices like the PlayStation 3 will be able to play back H.264 HD. But I want to... one of the things I'm kind of having second thoughts about, too. Does it really even matter that I could burn it into AVC HD in the file format and the directory structure that's necessary for it to play back on a spec drive? I don't think we even need to worry about that anymore. I think if you go H.264, you could play back on a PlayStation 3 also at HD quality.
And you got to remember that because of the popularity of DVDs and DV camcorders that are out there right now, a lot of these newer, and I know the PS3 does this as well, at least if you're connecting to your television via HDMI, will actually upscale.
Yeah.
I do video work on my Canon GL2, and for the most part, if it's a nice setting, if it's outside especially, you can't tell the difference between that and a really good HD. At least for the price. I mean, it looks fantastic. I don't need to record in HD to get close to HD quality on my output.
Yep.
And then when it upscales it, man, it just looks fantastic.
So I'm looking to kind of rebuild my... I've been a mini DV, HDV guy for a little while now, and looking to upgrade up to the tapeless SDHC cards that they are recording to.
Those kind of scare me a little bit. I don't know why. Maybe it's... I know you can reuse them and stuff, but I don't know. There's something about having the physical tape backup of whatever I recorded. But the problem is those tapes are not going to last forever.
Yeah, I have hundreds of tapes sitting there, and I'm slowly but surely pulling them into Final Cut, and then I'm backing them up on hard drives that I take to work. So I'm always afraid of the tapes just disintegrating after a few years.
Yeah, that's kind of my worry too. But then again, usually when I record something, it doesn't take too long before I'm getting it into the computer, I'm editing it, I'm creating whatever it is that I'm going to create, and then burning my DVDs, or actually what I'm doing now is I'm burning the DVDs, but I'm also creating a file to send to iTunes, so it's on the Apple TV.
I was going to ask you guys.
So, I don't know. Do you think
Apple's ever going to come out with a Blu-ray drive for a Mac?
Yes. Yes. Now that the format war is over, I think that... the next major revision to the MacBook Pro and the Mac Pro. Is that right? Mac Pro? MacBook Pro, yes.
Yeah.
I think they're going to support Blu-ray. I think it's going to be an add-on eventually. Probably before the end of the summer. At least one of those two units are going to have an add-on. But I think by this time next year, one of them is going to come standard with the Blu-ray. I don't know if it's going to be a burner. Probably a burner.
That would be pretty nice. I was looking at the new Toast Titanium 9.
Yep.
Yeah, and it has.
But I think Apple's going to build the ability to burn to Blu-ray directly into the system.
That'd be nice.
That needs to happen. I was talking to Primera, who make the disc duplicator. I had a look at those about 12 months ago, and they sort of said, "Oh, we have a Blu-ray version now. Would you like to have a look at it?" And the problem was is that they're having real trouble getting Mac software for it. Because they bought
Toast 9 will do it, but that wasn't available.
No, it wasn't then. And also, as well, they need a labeling solution that will actually integrate as well. And that apparently the label company they buy their software from is struggling to get their software working properly with the Blu-ray discs. Because it kind of
I will say that I think. Go ahead.
I was to say it needs to integrate all into the workflow, and also the Blu-ray disc needs to be available with the principal surface, which I think is also a sticking point at the moment.
I will go back and say that I think that when Blu-ray rolls out for the Mac, it'll be able to play Blu-ray movies, mm-hmm. although I don't think that's going to be a big factor for most people. But I think rather than burning a Blu-ray movie, I think initially it's going to be a data disc.
Yeah.
It's not going to be, you know, make your own, you know, Blu-ray movies. It's going to be to back up your data. And that's really what I want a Blu-ray disc for. I want to be able to back up 50 gigs to a disc. That's very appealing to me, but not if the disc itself costs $25.
No, that's a problem. And also, the only thing that concerns me about is that DVDs are so fragile. You know, if you really don't look after them properly, it's really easy to lose data on them. If you get the odd scratch, then they'll go bad. And you know, 50 gig on a disc, it scares me that I would burn data on there, think it was safe, and then, you know.
How are you doing it now, though?
Well, now I'm storing it all on the Drobo, and it's pretty safe on there, provided nobody steals the Drobo. But you know, at least with if it's on a magnetic medium, you kind of know it's unless somebody takes a sledgehammer to the unit, then or there's a power surge, it's fairly safe. Whereas you know, with optical, you always worry that the discs are going to get degraded somehow or scratched up. And I'm a terrible one for taking the disc out of the drive, and between me actually taking it out of the drive and putting it away, having written on the top of it with a marker, I've normally put it down the desk a couple of times and put scratches onto the thing.
Yeah, you know?
And even though every time I do it, I say, I must be really careful with this and not do that. Somehow they always end up scratched.
You know what I did? I got, a dolly, a long, round piece of wood.
Oh, yeah.
And I put it on another flat piece of wood, and actually two of them on this one piece of wood. And I just use that, and that's what I put my CDs and DVDs, the data ones anyways. And I just put it on top, and it slides down, and it's not the ideal solution, but it keeps them from getting scratched, and they're all in one relatively small location.
Yeah.
I should patent that, I guess. I don't know. Did you guys read my Trapped with iPhone blog post? I know, Lee, you've probably been working. I don't know if you had a chance to read that or not. Did you read that?
Was that when your car overheated?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, what happened was I was going to a job interview. Yep. For those who don't know, I'm looking for a job right now. The project my wife was working on for a big company was abruptly canceled, and everybody that was on that project was dismissed. So that kind of put our family into a bind. So it's a race right now between my wife and I who's going to find a full-time job. So I had an interview with this company for a Mac technician. And on the way over, this was actually the second interview yesterday, mm-hmm. Meeting with the owner of the company. I was really looking forward to it. And I'm usually really good in the interview. I don't choke, let me put it that way. But the problem was on the way over, I brought the minivan and my wife has a car too, but it's we've got four kids and plus my wife and I, so a regular car, you're not going to fit the whole family in a car, so we have a minivan, and I'm the one who drives the minivan, unfortunately. So I'm driving over to this interview, and the car starts to overheat. I'm going to say car even though it's a minivan. So I'm really worried about the car. I get to the barely get to the place, so I'm very distracted. I think I had a really bad interview. I actually talked to the HR woman today to tell her to apologize to him. His name was Timothy as well. I said, you know, this is what happened, and I wasn't at my best, so hopefully he won't hold that against me. But anyway, so I leave there. I start driving home, and it gets hot immediately. That temperature goes up quick. And I'm thinking, I bet the thermostat is shot in my car. One of these chain auto parts stores, I don't remember which one now, but it's one of those. It had a big red sign, I'll say that. I stop at that place, because it was real close to where I was, fortunately. And I just picked up a thermostat. I picked up a little ratchet set, and I just changed the thermostat right there on the side of the road. I hate working on cars, but I used to do it for a living, so I know what I'm doing.
Oh, good.
But nowadays, with these cars, especially a minivan, you can reach a few things, but most of it you just really can't do on the side of the road. So I change the thermostat, get back in it, start driving. That wasn't the problem. And this is where everybody's sitting there listening to this podcast going, why do I care about this? Well, I'm going to tie this into Apple technology. Just wait. You'll see. I could go about a mile and a half or less before I had to pull over, turn off the car, and let it sit for 15 minutes. The problem is I'm about 40 miles away from home. So after doing this for about 3 hours and getting about 5 miles down the road, I realize I'm not going to make it home tonight. There's just no way. So I pull out my iPhone, I fire up Google Maps, and I type in towing, and I find the closest towing company. I call them up, I ask how much it's going to take to get my car from where I'm at to where I need to go. It's going to be at least $150. So I said, thanks, no thanks.
Yeah.
Hang up, and I think, well, I'm just going to keep trying to go. It's not going to happen. About another hour later, I realize I'm not going to make it home. I also have, I should say, in the minivan, a Garmin GPS. I don't usually take it with me. What model is this thing? I've got it actually sitting right here because I don't leave it in there. It's a Street Pilot C340.
Right.
And it works pretty well, to be honest. I don't use it very often because most of the places I go, I know how to get there. But this job interview, I've never been to this company. It's in a different city, so this was really invaluable for me to have. You know, you don't have to leave an hour early just to make sure you find the place. Yeah. Which we've all done going to a new business. I'll go early so I make sure I, you know where I'm at. So I've got the Garmin with me. I've got the iPhone. I realize I'm not going to make it home. What do you do? I pull back out the iPhone, fire up Google Maps, and I do a search for auto repair. It says there's an auto repair on the road I'm on, but I'm not sure where I'm at this point because I'm in unfamiliar territory. And I can't see anything because it's nighttime. So I see the address that the iPhone is giving me. I plug that into my Garmin GPS, and it says it's only a mile and a half behind me. I already passed it, which I didn't notice as I'm driving down the road because my eye was glued to the street and my temperature gauge. Yeah. So I turn around, pull in there, leave the car. My wife drives there to pick me up. So that's where my minivan is sitting. They're supposed to get to it tomorrow, they hope. And that's how I tied it in with Apple technology. I used the iPhone, which would have been perfect if it had built-in GPS. I wouldn't even needed the Garmin, yeah. But I did have the Garmin, and it got me right where I needed to go. It showed me where the nearest garage was. Without that, I literally would have been looking at a phone book or walking down to the nearest gas station. Unfortunately, I was taking the back route, so there was no near gas stations. I honestly don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
You know, call my wife and say, look in the phone book, but we're in a different city. She doesn't have access to the phone book where I was. The other option would have been, of course, jump online and see what's close to me. Well, where are you? I'm on this road. How do you find the nearest thing from where somebody else is if they're calling you, if you don't know exactly where they're at? With the GPS and with the iPhone, it was simple. Yeah. I mean, it was great.
And you actually posted the blog from the garage while you were sat there waiting for your wife to pick you up.
Yep. Yeah, of course, the garage was closed when I pulled in there, so I had to leave the keys in the little drop-off envelope thing that they give you, and you slide it through the door, and they find it in the morning and give you a call and ask, why did you drop this off? Sitting there waiting for my wife to get there, and I've got at least 45, 50 minutes to kill, so I thought I'm going to use the iPhone to log into MyMac.com and actually post a blog. So if you go up to the blog site right now at MyMac.com, it's going to be towards the top. And it says, trapped with iPhone. Car is dead, posting from my iPhone. So I actually posted a blog using the iPhone, sitting in the middle of nowhere, really. So it was fun.
Yep.
It was neat to
do. I took my iPhone on vacation, and we had a similar situation. We actually left something in the museum that we were at, and my wife used her iPhone, looked up the museum, called the people, and they mailed it to us. It saved us a whole bunch of times. I just love having it. I don't know what I'd do without it.
What I really like is the ability in Google Maps on the iPhone is it will give you the nearest thing. You click it will give you more information, the address, the website, and a phone number. And if you just touch the phone, it will actually dial that phone number right there from your phone.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It really is.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hope they integrate a GPS chip in the iPhone, too.
It's going to kill the battery life, but for the situation that I had last night, I would much prefer not to have the Garmin.
Yeah.
Although, really, for driving, I don't know if the iPhone is going to be an ideal solution. I like the Garmin that, you know, it's up on the dash, it's heat resistant up to a point, the screen's bright enough, and it's really designed for driving with this. And I don't think the iPhone would fit that.
I've used the TomTom software on a Windows mobile smartphone for a while. That was my phone and also my in-car sat-nav, And that had a much smaller screen than the iPhone does. And provided the software's, you know, done properly, then it works pretty well, actually. I mean, to be honest with you, when you're driving, most of the time you're not... I'm not looking at the map. It's the spoken directions I'm listening to.
Yep.
And certainly an iPhone, you know, provided it has the volume to pump that out over the noise in a car, then it should be okay.
Well, if you've got it hooked up directly connected, like I do, I use the Harman Kardon Drive Plus Play.
Yeah.
Any noise that the iPhone makes actually kicks through my speaker, so a GPS that's voice spoken would work just fine.
Yeah.
Also up on the site right now, starting at the bottom, working my way up from the last podcast, Tom Schmidt had a really long article called File Launching Enhancements. It's basically bringing the old Apple menu back to macOS 10. Is that something either one of you guys, start with Lee, is that something that you're interested in, bringing back that old Apple menu type of application?
I kind of miss a couple of things from the old Apple menu, but I'm not missing it too much right now.
I moved on.
Yeah, I moved on.
And David, you were never a Mac OS 9 user.
I used OS 9 for about 3 months when in the mid-90s when the company I was working at, I was supporting them. They had a PCs and a Novell network, but they had one Mac that they used for desktop publishing, and I had to play around with Photoshop, and I did a bit of support on there. But that was really the only time I used OS 9 in earnest, so it's not a feature that I particularly miss, because I'm much more clued into OS 10.
Mm-hmm. Beth Locke has a book review called Running Windows on Your Mac. A lot of people listen to this podcast are recent switchers from Windows to the Mac. I think a book like this is really going to be helpful for a lot of people. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, no, it was a really great review, and the book looks like really good. It looks like it covers all the basics. You know, it really is. I think if for somebody who's new to the Mac and wants the comfort of being able to get Windows up and running, a lot of people are quite confused when they first come to the Mac about exactly what the options are for running Windows, you know, and really what the pros and cons of running Windows either through boot camp or via a VMware or Parallels solution. So a book like this will really sort you out and really help you understand how it all hangs together.
And listening to this podcast, I think, helps as well.
I would hope so. And, of course, always look to fenestration on the website, because that's one of the things I talk about quite a lot.
The other review that we've got posted from Owen Rubin, it's a box called Vudu. It allows you to rent or buy movies and watch them on your television. Now, Owen is really enamored with this. He gave it a 4.5 out of 5. The box itself costs $295 plus any movie that you rent or buy, but that's all it does. It allows you to download and rent movies. It kind of uses a BitTorrent type of service. Movies download very fast. I mean, you see one that you want, you hit play, and it starts playing pretty much immediately. And the problem, I think, here is, and I know all three of you are Apple TV, or all two of you are Apple TV owners, as I am. Uh-huh. Once you've had an Apple TV, a box that just plays movies that you rent or buy, and that's it, is very, very limited. Let's start with Lee.
Yeah, I think it's kind of smart the way they've conquered that first, the instant gratification thing by putting the first 10 minutes of all these movies onto the box.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty smart. And then, you know, working at Time Warner Cable, I've spent a lot of time looking at set-top boxes and saw some really bad ones in my time. Some were just like Linux machines running Tomcat server, and
ouch.
I'm like, wow, this is pretty complex for somebody in their house to teach them how to modify .config files on a Tomcat server. I was like, But I was a little intrigued by the Vudu box, but yeah, you're right. The sole purpose of the box, just to go out and watch movies or TV shows, I'm not sure if I could live with that.
Do you think that I forget who's making it now. Roku, maybe? Somebody's making a box.
Oh, for Netflix?
It's going to tie in with Netflix. So if you have a Netflix account, anything that they allow you to watch online, you can also watch on the box. The box itself is going to cost $99, and watching the movies are going to be, you know, it's tied in with your membership, so it's not going to cost you any more money. I think that solution will kill the Vudu in about 5 seconds.
Yeah, Roku's done a pretty good job with their audio devices, so I'm looking forward to taking a look at the Netflix one.
What do you think about the Vudu versus the Apple TV, David? Obviously, you don't have the Vudu, but you could see his review, and he actually has a movie up there, and it shows you the interface.
I think what Vudu have done is they're trying to address the non-Apple market. There are people, let's face it, who will not buy Apple equipment.
Blasphemy.
And I think actually there is a problem with Apple TV. And the problem with Apple TV is the same problem that, to an extent, the iPod has suffered from in the past, which is, I think, despite the fact that this is no longer the case, a lot of people assume that to have an Apple TV, you need to have a Mac. And even though, you know, with Apple TV Take 2, that's not the case. You can run an Apple TV perfectly fine without having any computer. You can just use it as a set-top box and download content directly from iTunes to it. I think there's a perception, which Apple hasn't really done an awful lot to overcome, that the Apple TV is a Mac complement box. And I think Vudu are aiming themselves outside of that market. However, having looked at the actual capabilities of the device, the fact that it doesn't have any sort of computer integration at all, to me, for the money, it's too limited, and it wouldn't be something that would interest me, even if I didn't already have an Apple TV. My gut feeling with this is actually this product is going up on the market, and they're hoping that somebody's going to acquire it, and it will become integrated with a cable service or Amazon Unbox or something like that in the future. That's my feeling about Vudu.
Yeah, I, as an Apple TV owner, I can already buy and rent TV and movies, but I also have, more importantly, access to all my content, so that was the deal breaker.
Exactly.
So we got to wrap up the show. We're approaching the hour and a half mark. We want to thank Mike Breed for sending in the feedback and the question. It gets us started on other topics. And if you want to send us a question or a comment, you can do so. I'm going to give the telephone number, but I can't remember it offhand. Does anybody remember it offhand? I cannot remember it. I'm really bad about that. I don't know why. Let me jump on our website and pull it up. All you have to do is call 1-801-938-5559. It's a Skype account, so you just leave a message there, and we'll play it here on the show. Again, congratulations to our winner of the Scotty Vest contest. I almost said concert again. I've got concert in my head. I don't know why. It's crazy. Anything else to say before we wrap the show up, guys?
Nope, nothing for me.
Just getting ready for WWDC. That's my whole next couple weeks.
When is WWDC? It's what, 3 weeks away?
Yeah, it starts June 9th.
June 9th. Wow, that's coming right up, isn't it? We're going to cover a lot of the iPhone happenings, of course, over the next month. Hopefully, Lee, you can get a hold of us while you're at WWDC. Maybe we can do a podcast with you there from your hotel room or wherever you happen to be.
And hopefully we can make some announcements.
That would be cool.
Very cool.
So thanks a lot, Lee, for joining us on the show. David, of course, as always, appreciate you being here.
That's my pleasure.
And we will be back next week. Hopefully, Guy Sura will be joining us again. He had karate tonight. And we'll find out what's going on with John Nemo's All Over the Mac.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.